listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
U.S. officials often ignore evidence of corruption by the governments of our Muslim allies, writing it off as an unimportant and unavoidable distraction from the real mission of winning hearts and minds and defeating insurgents. But in her latest book, Thieves of State, Sarah Chase warns that the ordinary people of Afghanistan, Egypt, Tunisia, Nigeria, and Uzbekistan have become so frustrated by the corrupt practices of their governments, which they see as sanctioned by the United States, that they feel driven to help or even join militant extremist groups. Sarah Chase, who's currently a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment, has worked as an advisor to the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff and as a reporter for NPR. We spoke in January, and we are rebroadcasting the conversation for you today. So just how widespread is government-sponsored corruption in Afghanistan or Egypt and the other countries that I mentioned?
These countries that you mentioned, it's extremely widespread. And it's not just widespread, it's, if I can use this term, it's vertically integrated. So we have a tendency to think of corruption as something that happens on the margins of a government. And what I discovered looking at these countries is, rather than it being a sort of failing or poorly performing government with that's plagued by corruption, in fact, it's a very effective criminal organization whose objective is really to extract resources, meaning steal the money from the people.
And it doesn't matter in a country like Egypt whether it's Mubarak or Morsi or al-Sisi?
So that's a really interesting question. What I discovered in Egypt, I was wrong. I went to look at Egypt thinking of it as a kind of archetype of a military corruption. It is. Sisi, Mubarak, and the military institution there controls something like 40% of the Egyptian economy. What I found that really surprised me was that wasn't the corruption that was upsetting people. What was upsetting people was a separate network, which was basically run by President Mubarak's son, Gamal, who had been working at the Bank of America in London, comes back and basically builds a crony capitalist network, privatizes all the state-owned enterprises into the hands of his cronies. And that's what was pissing people off.
Sounds like Russia.
It does.
But it doesn't piss people off in Russia.
Oh, yes, it does. But there's a really interesting distinction that you touch on by asking that question, which is somehow the military has a in Egypt, for example, has a different image. And its image is patriotic. Its image is, you know, connected to the independence struggles. And also they're quite careful not to fall into too much personal enrichment. They get to use all these fancy things that fancy hotels, and they get drivers and they get free food and stuff like that. But they don't have 18 Rolls Royces, which some of these crony capitalists do.
In Pakistan, a country that we used to talk about a lot when you were in Afghanistan, the military is pretty much the government and also the business structure.
That's exactly right.
There's a kind of state capitalism, even though it's supposedly a standard capitalist country.
So I would say that Pakistan is the country in the world that most closely resembles Egypt, a very similar situation where a frankly quite feckless military and ineffective military has convinced the population that it's the most effective organization in the country. So Pakistanis are upset about the corruption of their civilian leaders, but they give the military a pass. And you're right, in both of these countries, the military is essentially running the show.
And then a third country like that is Nigeria. But in Nigeria, we have an odd situation where people are complaining that the government is not sending the military in to fight Boko Haram and protect them. So
Nigeria is no longer a military dictatorship. And so what you see is a really other classic case of the military becoming, in effect, a revenue stream for the government. So there's a gigantic military budget into the billions. It way outstrips any other budget allocation. And yet soldiers on the front lines with Boko Haram don't have bullets to fire. And so you often see in countries like this that the kleptocratic network, if you will capture one instrument of force, which is its kind of enforcing arm, and then anybody else with guns gets hollowed out. And very often it's the police that serves this enforcing role, and the military, which tends often to be a little bit more professional, gets hollowed out and becomes, as I say, a revenue stream. And that means, you know, that U.S. decision makers need to think about that as they're partnering. You know, we've heard a lot about our partner engagements in the counterterrorism fight. Well, who exactly are we partnering with, and what use is our military assistance going to be put to?
You cite in this book the case of a bridge outside Kandahar that was rebuilt with international development money to illustrate some of the problems that you saw. Can you tell us about the work on that bridge and how it was done and how it came out so poorly?
That was the Tarnak Bridge. And this is classic, and it's classic in a lot of these countries. One way that corruption is experienced by ordinary people is they get shaken down by government officials, whatever they need to do, be it find a death certificate, you know, get a death certificate for their father, be it drive along the road.
You have to pay to get a death
Can you believe it? I know a guy whose father was blown up in an improvised bomb in a mosque, and he had to pay bribes to get the death certificate. I mean, in that painful a moment. But another way that money is skimmed off everywhere in all of the countries I've been looking at is through the public procurement process. And so what happens is contracts are padded. Shoddy materials are used instead of the ones that are in the contract. And in the case of Afghanistan, what happened, the money was coming from us, so it was international donor money, not oil money the way it is in Nigeria, for example. And there are layers and layers of subcontractors. So I get the contract, and without doing anything, I literally sell that contract to you. So I've gotten money because you've paid me for the contract. You then sell it on to a subcontractor. And it might go three or four layers. And that means the guy who's actually doing the work at the end doesn't have, because he's paid so much, there's not enough money in the contract for him to actually pay for the inputs and the salaries.
And local people you knew told you that they were frustrated to see the contractors who were supposed to have rebuilt the bridge driving expensive SUVs. Obviously from misappropriated funds.
Exactly. And that's another thing that I learned. I think there's a tendency for, you know, development professionals and things like that to say, you know what, corruption's just part of the deal here. And if, you know, 20 cents out of every dollar trickles down to the people, well, that's better than if they get nothing. And it turns out that's not the case, because people know how much these contracts are worth, and they're so enraged at the injustice. They're so enraged at this bridge springing holes again so they can't even drive across it when they see these contractors driving $80,000 vehicles, that they're angrier than if no money had been spent in the first place.
What is the situation with the bridge today?
I actually haven't been there in 2 years. I can't tell you.
But it was a substandard bridge. Is it safe?
It certainly wasn't safe during all the years that I was there. And sometimes it was so bad, you know, you would see holes in the actual surface of the bridge. You could look down and see the riverbed below. So we would all have to drive around the bridge and just ford the river, basically.
Last year, it was revealed that the CIA was giving former Afghan President Hamid Karzai bags filled with wads of money every month, to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, and that money didn't seem to buy us much influence. Does our presence sometimes fuel corruption?
It certainly fuels corruption, and that case is a very interesting one in that the United States government prosecutes businesses for bribing foreign officials. It's called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and we put businessmen in jail for this, or we fine them. And yet, sorry, the United States government puts them in jail or fines them. And yet, the United States government arguably is bribing foreign officials itself. And that's a very peculiar contradiction. And the whole story there with Afghanistan was quite contradictory, and elsewhere, because you have a lot of anti-corruption rhetoric on the part of U.S. officials, and then be it direct payments by the CIA or be it even our foreign assistance dollars are sometimes kind of pay-to-play deals, bargains, arrangements. And in that sense, we certainly do make it worse, and the populations in these countries see that we're making it worse, and that's why they become angry at us as well as at their own governments.
As you explain in the book, you've concentrated much of your energy over the past decade to finding a better way to fight corruption in some of these countries. How much of your focus has been on trying to convince U.S. officials to treat corruption more seriously?
A lot. And in fact, that's why I wrote the book, is because I had been working on this from a kind of operational level. I was actually creating operational plans at various different echelons with respect to Afghanistan, be it at the provincial level when the troop rollout was, you know, the surge was happening. I was saying we need a governance surge, and I had some very, very specific ideas all the way up to when I was working for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We developed quite complex scenarios and plans for how you could treat this differently. But nobody bit, essentially. And what I came to understand is people don't understand that this is a security problem. This isn't just, between quotation marks, about morality or ethics or development or all those nice soft-feely things. This is, we are creating, you know, 5 or 10 Taliban or 5 or 10 ISIS members for every one we pick off, when we pick them off by reinforcing a corrupt government.
You seem to have come to the conclusion after your experience in Afghanistan that the main reason for the existence of that country's government is to make money for the officials at the top, similar to the way the mafia or other crime syndicates seem to be structured.
That's exactly right. This is Tony Soprano, with a Federal Reserve, right? With
so
a
that
central
was Haman
bank.
Karzai, a man you knew,
yeah,
and you knew his brother.
Yeah. Two brothers. I worked for his older brother, his younger brother, who was assassinated eventually, who was well known for dealing drugs or facilitating opium trafficking. But that's exactly right. And it works as the way a mafia works in the following sense. The money moves upwards within this system. So the cop on the street corner who's, you know, extracting his, quote, petty bribe from you when you drive past him, he's
like asking you to pay for the pen,
yeah,
to sign that death certificate that you mentioned earlier.
Exactly, exactly. He pays part of that take up the line. So very often the cop in that position has actually bought his position. Then he has to, sometimes he's borrowed money to do that, so he has to pay that money back. And then he has to pay a kind of monthly amount. And so this money is flowing upwards. And what's flowing downwards is protection from repercussions, just like the mafia.
Now, how did you end up helping run an NGO for Khayyam Karzai?
I was an NPR correspondent, as you mentioned, and I was covering the fall of the Taliban. And one of my kind of key interlocutors was President Karzai's uncle. I like to go, he wasn't ever interviewed on the record, but I found that these elders, as they're known, were really helpful in explaining the context, the cultural context. So we became pretty good friends. And when I was passing off to Steve Inskeep, actually, who's now the Morning Edition host on NPR, I went out via Pakistan, and Uncle Aziz, Shah Kaka, invited me for dinner. And he was actually railing about corruption, too, but he was railing about the NGO's corruption. And he said the NGOs are all corrupt, as though the government isn't. And so we were sharing frustration about that. And then literally as I got up to leave, he said, wouldn't you come back and help us?
You defended Khayyam Karzai against charges that had been made against him on our show many years ago. And you admit in the book that in that job, you made all of the mistakes you've criticized other Americans
That's
for
exactly
making.
Right.
So he fooled you?
He did. He did. He's a brilliant man. He's taught me more about his country than anybody else did, but or almost. But the gap between what he said and what he did was enormous. And it's hard for Americans to kind of keep up with that. I think we have a tendency to take people at their word, at least at first blush. And so it took me a really long time to metabolize how barefaced some of the deceit was. And I think the same thing happens when U.S. officials are in contact or interacting with government officials in countries like this. We have a tendency to assume that they are as good as their word. We have a tendency to assume that they are acting on behalf of their people, when in fact they're not. And I watched time and time again as people cycled through, always giving the benefit of the doubt to these government officials, and it taking a year or two before they twigged to them.
My guest is Sarah Chase. Her latest book is Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. It's published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with the rebroadcast of a conversation I had with Sarah Chase last January. Her book, Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security, is published by W.W. Norton. I picked up the conversation by asking her, after you left NPR, you created a cooperative in Afghanistan that was selling soap and other artisanal products. Didn't you face a challenge getting permits?
Well, I first wanted to try to do it without me interceding. And so I sent our chief financial officer, we're a small cooperative, you know, we're manufacturing this stuff, actually. It's really wonderful. And he's an unflappable, you know, wonderful guy. He must have gone to the cooperative's office about once a week for 9 months. And always there was a form missing. The cooperative's director wasn't there. These are the ways that people, you know, it's the way they're putting their hand out. And we just refused to pay the bribe. Finally, I decided I better, you know, cut to the chase here and go. And of course, everything was in order and we filled out the papers and all that. And then we had to deposit some money in the National Bank. Sent Pashtun out. He calls me up. They want a bribe in order to deposit money in the bank, right? You have to pay bribes to pay your electricity bill. Can you imagine that? So they're asking...
I thought the electricity bill was a bribe.
Yeah, exactly. And they wanted a bribe for every signature on a piece of paper. And I said, look, sure, happy to give you the money, but I need a receipt because I have a board of directors. And that put them into a flurry. And the manager eventually sort of said, well, I guess she's right. And the clerk who wanted the bribe said, okay, come back tomorrow. I don't know how this happened, but next thing I know, I'm sitting on top of the guy's desk. And I said, fine, as long as it takes, I'll be here. That was very confusing for them. And we got our work completed. But what distresses me in hindsight as I look back at my efforts to break through this system is that I did allow people like this bank clerk to treat me like an exception. They would, you know, take care of my business and then keep shaking down the Afghans. And unfortunately, I feel like a lot of U.S. businesses that are now businesses can't pay bribes, but there are all kinds of ways that you can provide emoluments and stuff like that. And I feel like particularly, you know, extractive industries like oil companies or mining companies, they've got plenty of money. These are capital intensive investments. And I think they just want their business taken care of. And so what they're doing is they're actually enabling and reinforcing this kleptocratic system.
As an exception, did you find yourself to be a magnet for people who wanted to tell you what was going on? Because they all knew about it amongst themselves, but did they want the rest of the world to know?
Absolutely.
And Sarah Chase was going to be the way that they were going to tell the rest of the world?
Absolutely. And it was heartrending. I mean, I remember getting a delegation of villagers from a rocky, this is drought stricken, you know, it's really hard scrabble life. And Ahmed Wali Karzai, one of the Karzai brothers you just mentioned, was basically stealing their land and selling it. And they came to me, they were kneeling on my floor. And I tried as hard as I could to get the international interveners to confront Ahmed Wali about this, and to no luck or to no avail. And that's also why a lot of people have wondered, how was I safe when people knew I was connected to the Americans? And the answer is people wanted their voices heard by the Americans, and they saw me as a conduit.
One man, Nirala, former police officer, told you that he was so angry about how the police had treated his brother that he wouldn't warn them if he saw someone planting an IED.
That's right. And
that's pretty angry.
It was angry. And I don't think that's strictly true of him in particular. But at this point, we're talking 2008, 2009. In Kandahar, the Taliban are infiltrated into the city. Everybody I knew Taliban. If a Nurullah, who's a former police officer himself, was talking that way, my feeling is plenty of other people were joining up.
You've included a number of passages from books called Mirrors, written over the last centuries in Europe and the Middle East. For our listeners who aren't familiar with them, what are those mirrors?
These are really manuals for rulers, and I suspect most people know of Machiavelli's The Prince. That's probably the most famous one in the West. But it turns out that this was a whole literary genre, and courtiers or kings themselves or churchmen would write these manuals to tell kings how to rule better, and in particular, how not to lose their kingdoms.
And you came across many of those mirrors while you were studying medieval Islamic history in graduate school?
For my sins, yes.
The mirrors contain lots of advice, but one piece you return to several times is the warning to leaders not to get all their information through intermediaries, but to meet directly with the ordinary people and hear their concerns. That's pretty good advice, but wasn't that the kind of advice U.S. officials and military commanders you worked with often failed to heed?
Precisely. I spent a lot of effort trying to put senior U.S. officials in front of ordinary Afghans without, you know, some mediator there, because you had to know who was who. I remember seeing a State Department official come to talk to the chief of police of Kandahar, and I knew who that State Department official's translator was and was connected with the governor who was basically trying to undermine that police officer. So I told the State Department guy, you're not getting anything because he knows who your translator is and he's not going to trust that. So, for example, Jane Harman, who at the time was a congresswoman from California, she brought a congressional delegation and I happened to know her, and she reached out directly to me and said, what should we do in Kandahar? And I said, let me put together a group of elders for you. She said, great. You wouldn't believe how much China I had to break and she had to break to make this happen. It was not only the embassy didn't want it to happen, the regional command, military command didn't want it to happen, and only because Jane Harman is a tiger and because she trusted me were we able to bring this off.
And why didn't they want it to happen?
I think, you know, particularly when Congress people are visiting, those that they're visiting want to control the message. Mm-hmm. And if you had Afghans telling the Congress people what was really going on, that was going to get out of control.
We've seen that again and again in Vietnam, where we were told that we were winning a war that we weren't winning, for example. The same sort of thing in Afghanistan.
We've been told that year after year after year. And I hate to be a Cassandra, but I think what happened in Iraq is a really, you know, in the last year or so with ISIS, you know, coming in and taking over for much of the country, is a very sobering object lesson for what might happen in Afghanistan.
My guest is Sarah Chase. Her latest book, Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security, published by W.W. Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've written that you began to understand the connection between government corruption and civil unrest in a new way in early 2011, when you were working as a special assistant to Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Was that the start of what's known as the Arab Spring? Yeah.
It was. And so it was actually even a year earlier when I was kind of making this argument to a group of officers from police and military officers from about 45 different countries. I thought this was an Afghanistan phenomenon. And I described this vertically integrated, you know, system. And people came up to me afterwards and said, you just described my country. And when I looked at which countries were represented there, there was a violent insurgency in every one of them. That was before the Arab Spring. Then the Arab Spring erupted in early 2011, and Admiral Mullen actually sent me out to give him some ground truth.
You had spent time in Morocco when you were in the Peace Corps before. Were you totally unaware of what was happening in the government there?
That's really a great question. I had been so buried in Afghanistan that I hadn't really been thinking about North Africa. But when I was in Morocco back in the 1980s, there had been an extremely autocratic ruler called Hassan II. And, I mean, it was beyond corruption.
Well, we once had a woman who he had sent to prison for 25 years simply because she was the daughter of a former military leader who he suspected was involved in a coup attempt. She had nothing to do with it, and yet her life was ruined until she finally was, I think, broke out of prison.
It was an extremely autocratic government, and there had been a lot of hope for his son, Mohammed VI, that he was a young reformer and things like that. And there are a couple of issues. One is this corruption endemic does seem to have exploded sometime in the late 1990s. That's what I've found as I've asked people in each of these countries. And secondly, there is an incentive. So there's a difference between Hassan II's authoritarianism and what you might call the sort of economic, you know, extraction of the more kleptocratic governments. Secondly, in a lot of these countries, it's structured. And so you can be a new king, but you've got your uncles and you've got your advisors and things like that. And it's a whole network.
And we hear when somebody, a son usually, takes over, as we did in Syria, that he was educated in the West. He's he has different ideas and the situation is going to be a lot better. And of course, it doesn't turn out that way.
Yeah. I mean, where did sort of unbridled, deregulated capitalism come from? I mean, as I've thought about why the 1990s, I have to say I think back to both the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the communist experiment, which obviously was corrupt and hypocritical, but it did have a certain ethos that said you can't go too far down the road of, you know, ostentatious personal enrichment. And we kind of said, sure. Greed is good, you know. And so you get particularly the deregulation fever that President Reagan and Prime Minister Thatcher, you know, kind of promulgated. It really, I think, changed the ethos and took the brakes off a lot of these rulers. So in a funny way, you could see the explosion of very acute corruption that I've been looking at as not unrelated to the financial meltdown of 2008.
Many of these countries had been colonies of European countries. Is that reflected in any way in
really
how this has worked?
Really interesting question.
I mean, I'm thinking you mentioned Morocco, then you went to Algeria.
Right.
Former, such an integral part of France that many French people thought of themselves as Algerians until the Battle of Algiers.
Right. And that takes us also to Nigeria, which is a really interesting, case here, where you hear Boko Haram saying Western education is forbidden. And the way we hear that is, wow, they're against intellectual effort, they're against critical thinking, they're against tolerance, they're against people bettering themselves. Whereas within the Nigerian context, the education system had been set up by the British colonial authorities in order to generate civil servants, bureaucrats, right? And it's the civil service that through these padded contracts that we were talking about earlier is really stealing the bulk of the oil money in Nigeria. And so a lot of Nigerians see the education system as being a corrupt or a sort of corrupt intake valve into a profoundly corrupt system. And a lot of people say that in some of these former colonies, the new ruling elites, sadly, have just taken over the same extractive structures and oppressive structures that were set up by the colonial overlords.
But some of them have elections. Nigeria is about to have an election. And despite being called corrupt, good luck, Jonathan, wonderful name, he may very well be reelected.
Will he be reelected by the Nigerian people, or will he be reelected by people who can change the numbers on the vote tallies? I watched quote-unquote elections in Afghanistan, and, I mean, it's breathtaking.
The last election was we've come up with some kind of compromise because nobody's been willing to say just how much the vote tally was changed.
Correct. And 2009, the previous one I watched, I mean, and it was very sophisticated. The vote rigging is very sophisticated. And it's not, you know, people voting two or three times. This is wholesale, you know, stuffing of ballot boxes.
Toward the end of the book, you've included a chapter called Remedies, where you look at how U.S. officials, intelligence agencies, diplomats, and security agencies might work to confront and combat corruption overseas. Can you tell us about some of your recommendations?
This is really a toolbox because I think these situations are very complex, and I think the political trade-offs are complex. I'm not saying across the board, let's, you know, throw them all in jail. We're living in a world of political and diplomatic realities. And so what you don't find in this book is, you know, here's what we should do about this country or that country or the other country, because each one has its own particularities and the calendar matters too. So what I've tried to do is just counter what people say, often say to me, which is, well, what can we do about it anyway? Well, it turns out there's about 30 pages of various leverage that can be used. So my argument is, first, we need to stop actively enabling it wherever we can. And quite often, that means working here at home as well as in the country in question, because where do these people park their resources?
But what do we do when, with situations like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, where we have bases, we have where we rely on the country to allow us to fly our planes out to Afghanistan and other countries that we're concerned about, and yet the leaders are terribly corrupt. We look the other way. We've been doing that since the Cold War, haven't we?
We have, and that's the most difficult case, right? An Uzbekistan where we've got a lot of materiel we need to get out of Afghanistan, or a Bahrain where we've got our Fifth Fleet stationed there. And always in these situations, the short-term security imperative trumps the longer-term security imperative. And what I'm arguing is that by partnering with governments like this, we are actually generating the very enemies that we're partnering with them to combat. And so it's very self-defeating.
Isn't that what happened in Iran?
Exactly. Thank you, Leonard. That's, I think, a cost-benefit analysis that no one's ever done. I mean, everyone thought it was so great to be buddied up with the Shah because he was, you know, providing stability and things like that.
But to the Iranians, Mossadegh is still a living memory of something that they cite all the time.
That's right. And let's look at the cost to U.S. national security interest today of having made that bad bargain. And it's a bad bargain that really undermines us as a country. We're one of the only countries on earth that was founded on a set of ideals and ideas. And when we betray those ideas, I think other people around the world hold us accountable more than they would some other countries that don't make the pretenses that we do. And so fundamentally, it undermines our long-term national security interests.
Sarah Chase is an award-winning former NPR correspondent, a foreign policy expert, and an entrepreneur with 10 years' experience in Afghanistan. She is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment. Her latest book is Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. It's published by W.W. Norton. Sarah, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
The honor is mine.